Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the cast and creator of Squid Game talk to me about the phenomenon, Netflix's most popular TV show, as the third season finally arrives. Chris Wasser is here with the week's new movie releases, including Brad Pitt playing a Rocky Balboa-style F1 driver in the unfortunately named F1 the Movie. And we'll have all the week's TV and movie news and reviews you'll need for the weekend and week ahead. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're doing well. A lot of people still mention to me, it was 2 weeks ago at this stage, or maybe even three, I spoke to Don Lessam, who was the dinosaur advisor on the first Jurassic Park movie. And even though the chat was about Jurassic Park, it was also a bit about dinosaurs as well, which is clearly outside the remit of this show. But a lot of people enjoyed it because he was such an enthusiast for dinosaurs and kind of what they can teach children about the world. And he's had this great thing about how they're a perfect kind of linchpin between reality and fantasy for young kids, and how he encourages young kids' interest in dinosaurs. Anyway, he was talking in Dublin Zoo for the last two nights, and I got to interview him on the stage. And this guy is in the dinosaur world and the Jurassic Park world is a serious celebrity. There was people queuing up to get his autograph. There was people in the audience with Jurassic Park t-shirts. It was absolutely lovely to see, all in Dublin Zoo. So yeah, Don Lessam, check him out. He's written over 50 books on dinosaurs. And as I say, he was Spielberg's advisor on the first Jurassic Park movie. There's a new Jurassic Park movie coming next week. I'm not very optimistic because the last one was pretty atrocious, but let's see what happens. Let's get to this week. And this week in TV, I was watching this.
What if I wanted to open a restaurant?
Why a restaurant?
Why not a restaurant?
You already have a restaurant.
Yeah, but this would be a different restaurant.
Tell me more.
Every one of our good memories, they happen in restaurants, right? Like the Homer's ice cream after baseball. Restaurants are special places, right? And people go to restaurants to be taken care of, right? They go to restaurants to celebrate, to relax, to not have to think about anything else for a minute. No, people go to restaurants to feel less lonely.
Jeremy Allen White there, talking to kind of a ghostly character, but because John Bernthal is since passed as his brother in the fourth and indeed all seasons of The Bear. So The Bear on Disney Plus has returned this week for its fourth season. It's been a bit of a phenomena. It's been a darling of the Emmys. It's picked up loads. It's all about Jeremy Allen White taking over the family business and running this restaurant in Chicago called The Bear. Season one was brilliant. Season two was absolutely fantastic. Had an episode in it based on Christmas Day, which is one of those brilliant pieces of TV that's ever been made. A bit like an episode from The Sopranos called College or The Pine Barrens. Those was an episode from The Last of Us in the first season where you have a freestanding episode and it is just incredible. And you could watch it by itself as almost a mini movie. The best kind of TV imaginable. Season three went a bit up its own backside. Most people agree on that. But season four is back. And I'm delighted to say, so far, so good. I was kindly sent all 10. I've only watched 5 of them. But so far, it's very good. We're back in The Bear. They're reeling from the fact that they got a pretty bad review from the Chicago Tribune. I mean, that's a first world problem. They're all falling apart on account of it. But, you know, that's what makes the TV. Jeremy Allen White is back. And at the start of season four, their uncle, who's kind of, even though he's not really their uncle, Oliver Platt, is funding the business. And he comes in with a countdown clock of 1,444 hours. And this is how much time the bear has to save itself. And then it goes off in all sorts of interesting, deeply satisfying ways. The fourth episode, I think it is, does one of these brilliant episodes where it's one of the other chefs from the restaurant out getting her hair done, visiting her cousin, deciding if she wants to take a job somewhere else as a kind of standalone episode. And it's just brilliant. This is risky TV. And you know, risky TV isn't always entertaining. Someone can be risky and not be very good, but this is risky and great. So the good news is season 4 of The Bear, 5 episodes in, is great. And it's back to its best, I would suggest. So if you are a Bear fan, rest easy, my friends. It's now all there on Disney Plus, all 10 episodes. Spend the weekend watching it and see how modern great TV is made. And Jeremy Allen White, we were talking about last week, because he's going to be in the new Springsteen biopic of sorts, Deliver Me From Nowhere. And talking of musical documentaries.
And every time I've held a rose, it seems I only felt the thorns. And so it goes, and so it goes, and so will you soon, I suppose. But if my...
Oh, yes, the plaintive sound of one of Billy Joel's best songs, And So It Goes. Now, regular listeners know I'm a massive fan. So why am I playing that? Well, we got word, I'd known about this for a while, but we got word that there was a new documentary, a 5 hours plus in 2 parts, called And So It Goes, all about the mercurial piano man himself. The first part of this was shown at the Tribeca Film Festival, which takes in the first kind of half of Billy Joel's career. And the second part has yet to be seen by anyone, pretty much. Now, we got word this week that it's going to be on HBO Max in the middle of July. That probably means, I haven't got this verified yet, but it will be coming here on Sky Atlantic in some fashion. That's usually how these things work. So we should get it in July. I would make the case that whether you like Billy Joel or not, and his career is fascinating. A prodigious talent as a child who played on a broken piano. As in, he didn't just play the keys and they didn't work. He played around the notes. His father fled Germany in the 1940s because of the Holocaust, went to Cuba. His parents separated when his dad went back to Vienna, which is one of his famous songs. He grew up kind of desperately craving the attention of his father, being smothered in attention by his mother. We learn in this documentary, his mother struggled a lot as well. He signed terrible business deals. I mean, some of the worst on record. You know, his first album was recorded at the wrong speed. His brother-in-law took him to the cleaners. He made some terrible business decisions and then had tremendous highs, sold an incredible amount of albums. It's 150 million plus now. Played in Russia when it was still the evil empire. Played in a newly united Germany in 1990. Played Madison Square Garden for 10 years every month. Very complicated love life. A penchant for beautiful models seemed to be somewhat of his downfall. He had a... and well-publicized struggles with booze and other things like that. He's a fascinating guy, so I think this documentary is going to be exceptionally entertaining. And I know someone who's seen the first half, and they said it was great. And they have lots of people involved. They have him, they have his first ex-wife, who's never spoken before, Sting, Bruce Springsteen, Bill Clinton's in there. So this is going to be very good. So more to follow on Billy Joel, And So It Goes. A great documentary, I'm reckoning, coming soon. And we've a lot to get to on the show because of Squid Game and stuff like that. But I do want to mention, and we're going to be talking to Chris Wasser later. And 3 or 4 weeks ago, he reviewed a movie called The Ballad of Wallace Island. And that's a movie all about Tim Kaye dreams of reuniting his favorite folk duo, Maguire and Mortimer. And he invites them. They're both estranged, these people. He invites them to his island to perform a concert on this Wallace Island place. And Tim Kaye's in it, as I mentioned, Tom Basedon, Kerry Mulligan, and they were former lovers, this folk duo. And Chris gave it an amazing review, and I keep reading about it. And there was a piece in the Sunday Times last week about this slow burn of a life it's having, which is always a great sign of a movie. Comes out to little fanfare, but because it's so good, it continues to be seen by people. Now, I know in the UK box office, it's going gangbusters. On foot of very little promotion, I haven't seen it yet, and I'm trying to get to it this weekend, if time allows, because you can still see it in places like the IFI and the Savoy in Dublin. I'm not sure about elsewhere, but if you can, go and see it. Chris Wasser gave it 5 stars. It is being seen by lots of people by word of mouth. So this may be the movie of the year so far, The Ballad of Wallace Island, which I've yet to see, but I'm telling you to go and see it. Go figure. Now, up next, Squid Game is back, and I'll be talking to the cast and creator. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, let's talk about this. Yes, the creepy opening music of Squid Game. Squid Game is the most successful TV show in Netflix's history, a worldwide phenomenon. And season 3 is upon us as of this Friday, the 26th of June. If you don't know what Squid Game is, you've quite literally been under a rock. TV show about an underground tournament in which children's games are played until many of its players, or most of the players, die in a bid to collect lots and lots of money. It's from Korea. It's all in Korean for the most part. I mean, describing Squid Game or telling you what Squid Game is, like, it's now its own verb and indeed adjective. So, you know, kids dress up in Ireland like Squid Game characters in those pink suits. It is everywhere, has been hugely successful. Season 1 was off the charts. Season 2, people found less pleasing because I guess they went into it again. It was another round of Squid Game gains. Season 3 in the final season essentially is the second part of Season 2. Season 3 picks up exactly where Season 2 left off. There has been a revolution in the game, and 60 players have been left to continue competing for the plastic piggy full of blood money. Player 456, Ji-hun, played by Lee Jung-jae, is very sad at the start of this, and that's an understatement, because as you may remember, at the end of Season 2, there was an uprising which was viciously quashed, which means in the start of this, when we don't hear that much from Lee Jung-jae, Ji-hun, at the start of this. So Season 3 is full of spoilers that I do not want to give you, and they've asked us not to, and I understand why, because certain things happen that go wow. And it is a very twisty kind of show. But what I will say is, if you are a Squid Game fan, I think Season 3 gives you the satisfaction that you may want or may not. It's a hard one to call. But if you're a Squid Game devotee, and there are many of you out there, I think it will be a successful watch for you. But I am very keen not to spoil it, because it is spoiler rife. It is pregnant with spoilers, rife with spoilers. So, as you know, it is all in Korean. There are a few English parts when we hear some people talking who are watching the game. If you haven't seen Squid Game, you don't know what I'm talking about. But if you have, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. So I got to talk to a lot of the people involved in Squid Game. So first of all, you're going to hear my chat with director Hwang Dong-hoo, who is the creator of Squid Game and the director of it. And he's a very successful filmmaker in Korea. And he had his own kind of reasons for coming up with this story that involved his own kind of difficulties in life. Now, I should mention, this interview and the next few you're going to hear are all in Korean, because these people are Korean, big stars in Korea. And some of them do speak English, but the interviews were conducted in Korean because that's their first language, which I was delighted about. I don't think we've ever done this on Screen Time. So you will hear my interviews, but they will be in translation. And it was nice that we both spoke our own languages, because I can't speak Korean. I did try and say hello to them at the start, as you'll hear me butcher it. But anyway, first up, director of Squid Game and creator of it, director Hwang Dong-hoo. Hello, An Young-seo.
안녕하세요.
I can't speak Korean, I'm afraid, but nice to see you.
Nice and to see you.
Congratulations on the third season. I read this morning, and I'm wondering if you can tell me if this is true or not, that really this show began in your head maybe 15 years ago when you were struggling maybe financially and in your own position in life, and you had this idea of a game that you could play and you might win lots of money. Is that true, or is that the internet playing games?
That's partially is true.
When I first conceived of the idea and began writing it in 2008 or 9, I was in fact in debt, and I was struggling quite a lot financially, to the point where I had to sell some of the stuff, some gold that I had at home. And at the same time, I've always been a fan of the survival game genre. So, you know, some days I would be reading those graphic novels, and I thought that the games that you see in those stories, they're just too difficult. And I thought if I were to take part in a game like that, I would be eliminated immediately. So I got to thinking, what are some easier survival games? And that's where the idea began, and I was writing it. I thought it would be really fun to write as a feature film script. And I thought that it could be something that stands out from other survival genre stories.
Mm, fascinating. Forgive me if everybody has asked you this all day, but I'm so taken by how big a deal Squid Game has become. I was telling Park earlier that children here in Ireland on Halloween dress up like Squid Game characters. You know, this has had a life that I don't think anybody expected. And it's a very hard question, but can you put your finger on why it has been so successful? In 3 minutes.
I think, first of all, it had to do with the originality of the idea. The basic setup that grown-ups who are in debt risk their lives for a huge cash prize and play a survival game of children's games that they used to play in their innocent childhood, way before they got they had anything to do with being in debt. So I think that basic setup was very original and refreshing, and that's what appealed the most and succeeded in grabbing the attention of the audience. I also think that the huge doll, Yonghee, from the get-go had a lot to do with the success as well, because just that visual shock of seeing that huge doll, these people playing red light, green light, and also so many people ending up dying on that scene, I think it intrigued a lot of the viewers. I also think, you know, there are so many factors, but also the visuals played a huge part. The Yonghee doll, the pink guards, and those cross-cultural visual elements. On top of that, the music played an important role too. So I think it was just really a wonderful mix of all of these different elements that led to the global success. And I think another element, another factor was, this is something that actually a friend of mine, an American friend, shared with me. They said that, you know, at first glance, it may seem like a almost a cheap, if not, you know, just a commercial, violent, or even cliche genre, but that after seeing the show, there is a hidden message there. There's meaning behind all of it. There's criticism about the current world that we live in. So, there are things that you can have discussions and conversations with other people about in the show. At first glance, it may just seem like a very strange and violent survival genre show from a Eastern country. But the deeper themes that it deals with, you know, the criticism that it has on late capitalism, I think that also played an important role.
Absolutely. It's not just popcorn. Well, we are out of time, and continued success in whatever you do. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Director Hong Dong-hoi there, the creator of Squid Game and the director, talking to me in translation about the third season and the phenomena that has been Squid Game. The main character in Squid Game is Ji-hun. As you know, he won the first series, and he's back in season two and indeed season three. His character is very down at the start of season three because of the events at the end of season two. So you're going to hear me talk to the actor who plays him, Lee Jung-jae, very famous actor in Korea. You're also going to hear me talk to Lee Bung-hung, who plays the front man, who, for Squid Game people, knows he's the guy who's at the top of this hierarchy of this very vicious, vicious game. Again, he's a big star in Korea. He's also done some American movies. So here's my chat with Ji-hun, played by Lee Jung-jae, and the frontman, played by Lee Bung-hung, who I spoke to earlier in the week about the marvels of Squid Game. Lee Jung-jae, if I can start with you, you know, when we first meet you, you're kind of a joker. By the time we get to the third season, there are a lot of different sides to you. I presume, as an actor, this must be great for you, where the character has gone.
So I think I'm very lucky as an actor to be able to portray such a wide emotional landscape in just one project. While it was a challenge, I had a lot of talks with director Hwang and the rest of the cast and staff members to mold this character. And Ki-hoon goes through a lot of change in season one in and of itself, but in seasons two and three, his character arc is very profound. In season two, his rebellion fails and he loses his best friend, Chongbae. So season three is really about what choices will he make after all of that has happened and what action is he going to take. And as an actor, it was such a joy to play this guy. And in seasons two and three, I was on a very strict diet. I thought that it was only fitting that Ki-hoon loses weight more and more towards the finale because he's under so much stress and he feels so much fear. So in order to show that with his physique, I went on a very strict diet too.
Okay. Well, you look well today. Lee Bong, can I ask you, your character, I was talking to the director earlier and I was talking to him about the different levels of meaning in the show. And I wonder what your character, do you think he's entirely evil and bad? Or what could you say about that, do you think? Like, is there any redeeming qualities to him, do you think?
So I don't think he started off as a plain evil person. Before coming into the game as Hwang In-ho, he loses his wife and the baby that she was carrying in her stomach. And then there were a lot of betrayals from people around him. So he was really left at his lowest place before joining the game. And when he becomes a participant in the game, he sees that people are so cruel and they have all lost the benevolence and humanity inside themselves. And he also had to kill to survive. So after being put into very extreme situations and going through these extreme situations, he becomes this very pessimistic person who came to the conclusion that there is no more remaining hope in people and in this world. And when he sees Ki-hoon, who wants to dismantle this game and this system, he kind of sneers at him. He thinks that you're going to come to your senses now or later. You'll become just like me. And that's why he puts him back in the game.
Yeah.
And while in season three, you can't really read his emotions because of his mask, I think he felt a little bit differently about Chun-hee, the pregnant girl, and the baby. And when he sees Ki-hoon, who wouldn't give up that hope, I think part of frontman also kind of wanted Ki-hoon to win and prove himself wrong. So I think frontman, approach frontman thinking that he also harbors that one last remaining piece of benevolence inside of him.
Yeah, we're out of time, but Lee Jung-jae, in one word, is it true you were discovered when you were working in a coffee shop? Or is that the internet?
You're correct. That is true.
Excellent. No more needs to be said. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you very much.
Lee Jung-jae and Lee Bung-hung, the actors who play Ji-hung and the frontman in Squid Game. If you don't know anything about Squid Game, none of these people will make any sense to you. If you do, you'll be hung on their every word. Now, finally, in season two, we got to see one of the guards in Squid Game and what was going on with her. The character Kang Nuel, played by Park Ji-young, was a North Korean defector who now turned undercover guard in Squid Game and had her own reasons for becoming a guard in Squid Game. She's a very successful actress in Korea. As you may remember in episode 2, we saw her as a giant bunny in a kid's theme park when she had left North Korea. So she's a really interesting character in this, and her story continues to be very interesting in season 3. So here's my chat with the actress Park Ji-young, who plays Kang Yu-el, the undercover guard in Squid Game in season 2 and season 3. You were well known in South Korea because you've been on TV and movies. But now people in Dublin, Ireland, and in New York and South America want to talk to you. Is it very life-changing, this level of success with Squid Game?
Honestly, I really haven't felt this great change in my life in a way that was really skin deep for me. However, it's only by doing interviews like this with you, coming to London and meeting the fans and doing promotion here, that I get to really experience, wow, this show is really globally popular and that there's a huge amount of interest from fans.
Yes, there certainly is. Your character is very interesting. We see her at the start as a nice pink bunny. And then the next thing we know, she's doing kind of awful things in a purple suit. It must be very interesting as an actress to play the arc of that role.
Truthfully, those two images may seem the opposite, the pink bunny and the pink guard. However, I think there are similarities between the two. Noel is a character who experiences immense despair, leaving her daughter behind in North Korea. And in that sense, experiences this guilt and deep sorrow. And there might be some similarities in hiding behind both masks. However, when she's a pink guard, as you say, she does these terrible things. But I think it's really hard to say whether she's actually a good or bad person from that. The one thing about her is that she has this incredibly strong ego, that as a human being, she knows deep inside what's the most basic value and worth and integrity she should have when treating other human beings.
Very interesting. The mask idea is interesting. Two masks, but they're a mask. Maybe people ask you this a lot, and you're one of the actresses in it, so maybe it's not your job to tell me, but let's try anyway. I read so many different things about what the message of Squid Game might be, that it's a study of society. It might mean something to do with North and South Korea. There's all sorts of theories about what it's about. And I'm wondering, do you have a sense of what the message is? And maybe you don't have to have one because you're playing a role in a fantastic TV show. But I wonder, do you ever think, what's this all about? What's this trying to say to the wider world?
Well, first of all, I really think that those characters show the different people who are on like totally different extreme sides. That's what characters portray in our real life. And also, I think this series like gives some space and room for the viewers to like question themselves. Am I like pessimistic or optimistic towards this world, or am I like humane or inhumane about something? And I am I like do I think that numbers are important, or like friends are important, or enemies are important? Like this kind of question, all these kind of questions like related to humanity. So I think this series gives chances for the viewers to like question themselves. I think that's the ultimate message of this series.
Yeah. Your English is very good, and you've just started talking in English, which I was surprised about. And it's a lot better than my Korean. So I appreciate you talking to me in English. You were a student studying fashion in university. I wonder what you make of the fashion in Squid Game, those suits that children here in Ireland wear at Halloween time. Do you have any thoughts on the fashion in Squid Game?
Would you like game fish?
Well, I've never thought about like how like those costumes are like well in like trendy or not, but I really really like those like pink suits personally, because I know that it's one of the most iconic like costume and iconic character in Squid Game. So Personally, I really enjoyed like wearing those pink suits and those masks.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm sure they're fun. And then the last thing, I was just looking at your career this morning on Wikipedia, where we check everything. And I was looking at all the things you did, but it sounded like a fascinating show. The title was It's Okay Not to Be Okay, which is a great show. What or a great title, but I haven't seen the show and there wasn't time to watch any of it. What's that show about?
I would answer this in Korea. I'm
That's
sorry.
okay. No,
It's a
no
really
problem.
complex issue. So, I got
We all live our
모든
lives having our own individual idiosyncratic flaws, and everyone has different personalities, so we all have different kinds of flaws. And whatever flaws they may be, it's okay that we can be loved despite having these different flaws, that we don't need to have any prejudice, discrimination against one another, and still survive. That's ultimately the message of this drama. It was relatively successful in Korea, very well loved by the audiences. So if you do have time, I really recommend you give it a go.
I will definitely do that. I will definitely do that after Squid Game. Very nice to talk to you. Continued success. And thank you for speaking English to me as well. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Park Ji-yeon-young there talking to me, mostly in translation, but somewhat in English as well. And she plays the undercover North Korean defector guard, Kang Nuel, in Squid Game Season 3. So that was the guys and gals from Squid Game Season 3, all in translation for the most part, which I was kind of pleased about. We've never done that before. And fair play to the translator who was translating rapidly for us. Squid Game 3 is satisfying in the Squid Game storyline, I think you'll find. I'm really not discussing it because it is rife with spoilers. I will say the violence ups an ante in this one. It was already pretty violent, but God, it's full on in this. So do be prepared. It is fiction, so you know it's not real, despite any real world parallels it may be making. But Squid Game 3 is there now for your streaming enjoyment on Netflix, and the whole seasons are there now, and the finale. Six episodes in season three. Up next, the week's new releases, which include F1, the movie. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time. Time to look at the new cinema releases, movies that are coming to the cinema. We've been talking a lot about TV. The big new release of the week is F1, the movie. That's a pretty obvious sounding name, I think you'd agree, starring Brad Pitt. We also have Megan 2.0. You may remember Megan, the first movie from a few years ago. Delighted to be joined now by arts journalist and film critic Chris Wasser. Chris, hello.
John, hello, how are you?
Very good. It's a pretty dull title, isn't it? F1, the movie.
Yeah, you know what? F1 is fine. But in recent weeks, maybe about 5 or 6 weeks ago, the movie was added on, and no one has come up with an explanation yet as to why that is. You know, there's been whispers that it might have something to do, it might be a licensing thing. I have my own theory that maybe the studio might not have trust the fact that people will know that it's a movie, that they might think it's a Formula One documentary, despite the fact that Brad Pitt is on the side of every second bus in town. But for whatever reason, they've decided to just let us know it's the movie. You're right, it's a stupid title.
And before we get to what goes on in the movie, this is very much, I was going to say, state sponsored, but it's sponsored or certainly given heavy approval by F1, the organization that runs Formula One.
Oh, you better believe there are times where this looks like a very expensive commercial for the Fédération Internationale de l'Automobile, which is the FIA,
Okay.
and they are the governing body of the Formula One World Championship. And in order to give F1 that authentic feel, which it certainly does have, it was made with their full cooperation. And you know, there's a lot of backing in there. There's a lot of advertising going on. So yes, it looks like there's a rumored budget, rumored of $300 million with this. That maybe and
Wow.
maybe they made some back on advertising with this. Joseph Kaczynski, the director, says it's close to 200. Not too sure about that. But yes, it does look like a very expensive ad. A slick one, though.
And I keep putting off you getting to the story. I promise we will. But in a way, this is pushing an open door. It's not my sport of choice, but F1 Grand Prix around the world every couple of weeks or months is huge in terms of eyeballs on TV screens. So they're pushing an open door, you would think.
Oh, they really are. And this thing is purposely designed to, you know, to make you sweat, to get the blood pumping and to somehow convince, you know, the naysayers, and I'm one of them, you know, I don't really have much of an interest in Formula One racing or any sort of car racing at all. It's to make you, it's to somehow, it's there to convince you that you should be interested, that this is the only sport worth caring about. And again, it isn't, not by a long shot, but it does that very effect. We will get to the story, but it does that very effective thing of even for a moment making you think that, oh, wow, I've been missing out. And that in a way is the sign of, you know, a sports movie that's been very well put together, you know, where you're all of a sudden interested in something you never really cared about before.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I suppose hats off for that. If it works on that level, you have to admire what they've pulled off, possibly. Okay. Without further ado, then, what's going on in F1, the movie?
Yeah, I mean, F1, the movie, it does actually have, you know, a little bit of a story. Not a great one, but there is something there. So you have Brad Pitt playing this guy named Sonny Hayes. Fabulous name. Better than F1, the movie. And he is this driver.
Sounds like a boxer.
He does sound like a boxer, yeah. And he might remind you of a certain movie boxer after a while, too. But he's this driver for hire who used to just have everything. He used to have the world at his feet. Back in the 90s, when he was in his 20s, Sonny was the next big thing in Formula One racing. Unfortunately, a gnarly accident just changed everything. He was involved in an awful car crash on the track, ended his career, almost ended his life, fell into a bit of a gambling addiction afterwards, and he just sort of disappeared from professional racing. We meet him at the beginning of the film living out of his van, and you know, everything said, you know, based on the life that he's led, he should look a bit, you know, rougher around the edges. He doesn't. He's ageless. He's Brad Pitt. He looks fantastic, but he doesn't seem to have any sort of, you know, life plan. There's nothing. He doesn't really think about tomorrow. You know, when we see him at the beginning, he is helping one squad win the 24 hours of Daytona race, but tomorrow he'd be back in the road looking for his next challenge. He's sort of a nomad. That's about to change because an old friend named Ruben, played by Javier Bardem, he is the owner of this Grand Prix team called Apex. And it seems the Apex crew are in trouble. They've had a rough season. They need a win. They might even need a miracle. And Ruben has decided that he wants his old pal Sonny, because these boys used to race together back in the days. He wants Sonny to sign up for Apex. You know, it'll be a bit of a publicity thing, bringing back Sonny Hayes, the former would-be star of Formula One racing. But he also knows that Sonny is the best in the world. And he might be able to not just save the Apex team, but also save Ruben from bankruptcy. So, you know, you have this thing, John, where Sonny's like, no way, but then we wouldn't have a film if he doesn't sign up.
Yes.
So he does sign up. He's on the track. He's causing headaches for the younger driver, Apex. That's JP Pierce, played by Damson Idris. He's causing headaches, but also, you know, making googly eyes at the technical director of the company, Kate McKenna, played by Kerry Condon, who, I love this, holding on so tight to a terrific Tipperary accent in there, which is brilliant. And look, I don't need to tell you what happens next. You have this thing where the veteran is clashing with the rookie superstar. You have the brainy car people in the background trying to think of new ways to make cars go faster. I didn't think they could. And you also have this case where are Case and beautiful Brad going to end up together? They might, but then someone might also end up in hospital. It's following a formula that we've seen done so many times before.
Okay, there could be a pun in there with the formula, but let's move on. So look, that sounds very obvious, a piece of storytelling, but you know, there are only a few stories in the world. So is this an affecting piece of storytelling?
Yeah, it is and it isn't. I think in one sense, it might be the most satisfactory big screen release of the summer because it sets out to do something and it achieves that. But it's not going to, you know, it sets out to kind of thrill you with car racing and have Brad Pitt, you know, make you believe that Brad Pitt is, you know, the best Formula One racer in the world. And for a minute, you kind of do. But at the same time, that story needs work. I mean, it won't win any points for originality and it's not going to here. I mean, if you swap out the cars for fighter jets, you've Top Gun Maverick.
And that's, Which was the same director.
I mean, exactly. Yeah, you have Joseph Kosinski. The last thing he did was Top Gun Maverick. And he's made an almost identical picture here in terms of how it looks, in terms of how it sounds, the way that it plays out. I mean, at one stage, I was even thinking if you give Sonny Hayes a fedora and a leather coat, he might be Rocky because he's kind of doing that thing where he's, you know, wandering around hallways, bouncing a ball off the ground, constantly being told that he's too old, that he's missed his chance. And I thought, this is a Rocky film. It's actually a Rocky film with cars. And you also have this thing that you keep thinking to yourself, this is just a big ad. And for Formula One, what are they going to do next? Is there going to be a FIFA World Cup film? Is there going to be a Tour de France film? Mm-hmm. I don't want to see that happen. But at the same time, there is something thrilling here. When Sonny is in his car, when Damson Idris's driver is in his car, JP, when Kate is on the sideline being a, you know, the brilliant technical director that they need, this thing just, it just holds you. It just, it, you know, it rattles your bones. You think it's going to loosen the seats that you're sitting in. You know, see it on IMAX if you can, because it is quite effective. It does, as I said at the top, what it needs to. It's very effective. When the drivers exit their vehicles and start talking, it's a little bit too hackneyed.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I watched the trailer, and just based on that and a couple of clips, I agree with you. It's great to see Kerry Condon being so Irish in it, as nature intended. But like, we've seen Brad Pitt look more haggard than this. Like, even as far back as Seven, he looked a bit more lived in. I nearly think he looks too good in this for the type of character he's supposed to be playing. Like, he's meant to be world weary. He looks like he's stepped straight from the beauty chair.
Oh, he's terrific looking in this, I have to say. It's just, it is, it's
But
too
is that
much.
Not a bit incongruous?
It is, you know, and it's a major distraction.
Now, it may be just jealousy on my part.
Well, it might be the same. It might be the same for me. But the whole time I was thinking, you know what? I feel like he's his usual unflappable self. It's quite a difficult one, John, in this film. But I also thought to myself, he kind of entered his Paul Newman phase, where he just, you know, makes everything sound and look good, even though you're kind of thinking to yourself, it's not. This is not the best thing you've done. But I kind of believe that you think it might be one of the best things that you've done, and maybe that's all that matters. But as good as he is here, and he is, I was thinking to myself, another old school movie star might have made this thing just light up altogether. Yeah. And I think that movie star is the one that's been sharing the red carpet with him this week, helping him promote the film, and that's Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise, despite the fact that he did his Days of Thunder thing. Well, it's not as if you can say Tom Cruise likes to, you know, reinvent himself with every picture. He's made eight Mission Impossible films. But he would have been perfect for this. And he probably would have made it even better. But we got Pitt. He's fine. He's very lucky to have that supporting cast. I thought Kerry Condon was just delightful. She has that very difficult job of, you know, explaining all of the technical stuff, especially for people like me. But she does it brilliantly. And I like that she's Irish. And you also have Javier Bardem, who, you know, you might say on one hand he's collecting a paycheck here, and then the other, it's like, well, he's also having fun devouring scenery in a big summer blockbuster. And I like seeing Javier Bardem doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, I can get with that. So listen, it sounds like you're saying two things, like a real spectacle. Don't watch it on a phone. Watch it on a big, dirty IMAX screen. Yet the story is just kind of too pedestrian and obvious. So I'm curious what star rating you're going to give F1 the movie.
Yeah, it is too pedestrian and obvious, but at the same time, I suppose we're not here to watch Brad Pitt rewrite the sports film rule book. Some patterns are there to be followed, and this one, you know, it makes a lot of noise, and, you know, it looks and sounds like every other kind of race car feature. Not as good as, let's say, Rush, or not as charming as Ford versus Ferrari, but, you know, it takes a respectable third place, I think. So look, it has its problems, but it is, as you say, it's worth a trip to the pictures, because this thing has a deal with Apple. Apple were also involved in the funding, where it will play in the cinema for a couple of months, then it will go to Apple. Don't wait for it to go on streaming. Go see it in a cinema. 3 stars.
Okay, 3 stars. If you had said third place on the podium, you would have really sealed the whole, you know, F1 pun, but you just weren't up to it, unfortunately.
No.
But a good review nonetheless. Chris gives 3 stars to F1 the movie. Strange that it has that added title in it, but it does. It's now in cinemas from this Friday, Chris, or this Thursday?
This Thursday, actually. Thursday,
yes. One of those Thursday releases. So from the 26th of June, it's there now. Chris gives it 3 stars. Let's take a flavor.
You've got an entire assembly line of kids raised on a simulator.
No, I don't have time for some kid to learn how to come in 10. I don't.
Well, you don't just walk off the street and pilot a rocket.
Yes, you can if you've done it before. That's the whole point. Louis Chiron was 57 years old when he won the Monaco Grand Prix.
Who is who?
Philippe Tancelin, 56 years old.
You just Googled these names, didn't you?
Some people look at Sonny Hayes, they see a guy who lives in a van, a gambling junkie who missed his shot.
Wow, Ruben, you are really selling this.
But I see a guy who makes teams better. I see experience, I see know-how.
You're off your meds.
My rook is a phenomenal talent. Phenomenal! But he's young. You know what he lacks? Maturity. You plus him, boom, I got a team.
A flavor there of F1 the movie, which Chris Wasser gave 3 stars to. And he's saying, if you're going to see it on the biggest screen possible. It's one of those movies. Now, something very different. Megan 2.0, and that's Megan where the E is a 3. You may remember the original of this movie, which is just called Megan, from a good few years ago now at this stage. All about a doll that got life and did bad things or something like that, right?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah, it's a robo doll Pinocchio sci-fi horror thing. They can put that, you know, unintelligible on the poster. And Megan, for the uninitiated, stands for Model Tree Generative Android, or we'll just call her by the name that her roboticist creator gives her in the first film. And that first film, John, I got on very well with. I thought it was just a hoot. It was very funny, genuinely freaky, chilling, feverishly violent in places, but, you know, it had the humor and the goods to back it up. And I think everyone involved knew what they were doing. Jared Johnstone was the director. Kayla Cooper came with the story. James Wan, you know, who's sort of, you know, the big chief at, you know, I think it's Atomic Monster, but also works with Jason Blum, because Blumhouse is involved in this. They were all onto something special with this, you know, original robo-doll horror that, although it kind of was inspired by everything from Chucky to Annabelle to Terminator, it very much did its own thing. And it had this.
And was quite successful, I think.
Very successful, yeah. Made for something like $12 million and made $180 million at the box office. And had a very, very simple story, which was this comically absurd scenario where you have this brainy roboticist played by Allison Williams, who's so good in these, you know, sci-fi horror roles. She designs this demented AI companion for her orphan niece after she, you know, loses her parents in a car accident. And everything goes wrong because this robot, you know, is designed to look after this little girl. And if anybody comes in the way of that little girl, even like a classroom bully, the doll tries to kill them. So it's, you know, we've seen a little bit of that in other films before, but, you know, there was enough originality in there. There's enough humor, horror, sci-fi goods that, you know, when the sequel was announced, I thought, let's go. I'm not thinking that anymore, unfortunately.
Okay. So what happens in Megan 2.0?
Well, as I say, like, a sequel was inevitable, but it really didn't need to be this complicated. So I'm going to try and break it down very, very quickly.
Top where line you have... is fine. Do we have a new Megan in it?
We do. We've got this new unkillable android. Her name is Amelia. I'm not going to go into what that stands for. she's actually played by a real actress, as opposed to having, I think, maybe a young actress in the suit of Megan, but then being voiced by two different actors. Doesn't really matter. Okay. This time you have Ivana Sackno playing Amelia, who's another creepy, self-aware Tresh with ulterior motives. She was originally designed for warfare. She was actually designed from the original blueprint for Megan that was stolen off of Gemma. But anyway, none of that matters because Amelia has gone rogue. She is determined to bring about a sort of end of days situation, bring down civilization, at least in America. And now Gemma, who is this conflicted Geppetto, where, you know, she's kind of rallying against AI after the events of the first film, even though she was all for it at the beginning of that. She needs to build a new body for Megan, who was the scoundrel from last time, to help take down that upgraded baddie. Does that sound like any film that we've seen before, John?
Quite possibly.
It's pretty much Terminator 2.
Yeah, I was going to say, where they send Arnie back to take over his guy who was his further prototype or whatever. Yeah, it sounds exactly like Terminator 2, now that you say it. Okay, Terminator 2 is one of the great action movies of all time, though. I'm sensing this may not be.
Yes, it borrows shamelessly from Terminator 2 to the point where I would actually be wondering what James Cameron thinks of this and if he thinks maybe a phone call to his lawyers might have to happen. And it talks so much around the scenes that feel as though they were lifted from that film that it's almost you start to feel, oh, do they know that they're nicking some good stuff here, you know, and are they trying to distract us? I just think that Jared Johnston, they've taken a simple, effective format and they've completely over-egged the pudding. It's just so crowded, so convoluted. Everything is bigger. Everything is not better. It's noisier. It's longer. You had like this maybe 100-minute horror the last time around. This one passes the 2-hour mark. It lacks the depth. It lacks the ideas, the discipline of its predecessor. You know, again, such a simple story. This one is, you know, at one point we have Megan, you know, jumping off of cliffs and flying down into these, you know, whatever the factory where Amelia is made. And I'm thinking the last one was about a killer doll in the corner. Like, how did we get here? And I just think as well, like, original ideas are non-existent, which there's a lot of that going around this week. It's bigger doesn't mean better. And I wish someone had told Jerry Johnstone that.
Oh dear, oh dear. Because hope springs from the first one, but clearly they've just gotten this completely wrong. So over-egging the pudding entirely, it seems.
I think so, yeah. And also, it brings out the worst in everyone involved, because we had some nice performances there, particularly from Alison Williams in the first film. But here, she's required to kind of kick back against everything, all the good work that she did in the first. Mm-hmm. And she's also required in the second half of the film, without giving anything away, to go full on, you know, Sarah Connor-like.
Yeah.
And it doesn't suit the story. This is supposed to be, you know, an absurd satirical chiller about this, you know, technologically advanced kind of killer doll. And they've forgotten all about that. I wish they had kind of just made a smaller film, because actually Kate Dolan, an Irish filmmaker, is in charge of the spin-off Soulmate. There's a number 8 in there, which is coming early next year. So that's a Megan spin-off, and that's another smaller horror, which is actually a bit of an erotic thriller about potentially a sex boss. So those kinds of things work when they take place in, you know, a relatable sort of environment. You know, if you keep the killer dolls or the sex dolls or whatever they are in the home, they're genuinely more terrifying. When you expand them out, and when you have, like, you know, fights between two robots and guys with guns and you know, these big robot factories, it just doesn't really work. It worked for James Cameron. It doesn't work for anyone else.
Yeah. So this is a complete mess. What are you going to say stars-wise then for Megan 2.0?
Oh, a complete mess. Not funny, catastrophically stupid in places. And unfortunately, it does hint at another one. If they do go for another one, you know, just look at what worked on the first one. Don't try and make another one of these. So it's 1 star. I thought, John, at times it was just practically unwatchable.
Wow, that bad. Wow, it's really bad. And so bad, we're going to make another one. Oh, dear. Well, that smacks of best avoided. I mean, if there's nothing else, maybe. But Chris is saying definitely not. 1 star for Megan 2.0. But based on the week's new releases, F1 is probably worth a trip to the movies. Because Chris Wasser, F1 the movie. God, I nearly forgot. They'll be getting on to me next. F1 the movie is given 3 stars by Chris Wasser. Chris, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
Chris Wasser there, reviewing the week's new movie releases. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to the great Jim Sheridan about his new movie, Recreation, which is a recreation of the trial that never happened of Ian Bailey, the chief suspect in the Sophie Tuscan de Plantier murder case. So I will have a long chat with Jim about that and a bit more to talk to him about as well. So that's all to come next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Thank you all for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I will talk to you next week.